Hi, my name is, I always forget that part. I'm Charlene Deal, and I'm the director of Thin Air, so this is kind of my party. This is my big dinner party that I plan for two-thirds of the year, and then I get to welcome all these people, that many of whom I've never met, except for through their words, and gather them together in this big party, and I'm so glad you joined us. I'd like to take a second tonight to acknowledge our sponsor, Investors Group. And you see, if you don't think I have any natural wit, I'll just point out that I thought Investors Group would be kind of an appropriate sponsor for an evening called Surviving Adolescence. I know there's sort of that thing going on there. You like that? Okay, you can check it. All the other sponsors have a little kind of link to the theme of the night. That'll be like a project. There'll be a quiz way later. Maybe on the online survey, which, see, that was a nice segue, too. I'm really on tonight. At the end of the festival, we're putting up an online survey on our website. Can you say winnipegwords.com? Yeah, good. Can you say it again? We'll post an online survey at the end of the festival for those of you who would like to give us some sort of global feedback on how the festival has made you feel. The beefs and bouquets are all welcome, and I'm happy to say that those of you who do that survey will be eligible to win a $200 gift certificate from EQ3. This is my Vanna moment. That's not for the writers. Sorry, guys. This is for the furniture, which is lent to us each year by EQ3, and we're very happy about that because it's a beautiful stage, don't you think? Yeah. And I don't actually think you could get all this furniture for $200, but I'm pretty sure you could get something pretty cool over there. It's a great store. Okay, so I'm really wandering about here. Now, I will remember again to say please turn off your cell phones, because there's always at least one cell phone pops up in the middle, and oh, I just find that so frustrating. And I may have survived adolescence, but I might stomp out there with these, you know, killer boots and cause some damage, which I don't really want to be responsible for. Oh, music to my ears. Thank you. Any more? Oh, that's it? Only one? All the rest of you figured this out before you came in? This is excellent. Also on tonight, I was thinking about surviving adolescence, as the theme of tonight, thinking also this could be, for me, surviving festival frenzy day, because we're really in full blast at this point in the week, and I would just remark to those of you who've come here that the other options tonight are... Oh, I heard another one. That sounded so good. There's the first night of Foyer des Écrivains programming happening at CCFM, and that runs tomorrow night and Friday night as well, so if you are a person who can listen well in French, you'd be welcome to join the crazy gatherings over at the CCFM. It's a really wonderful place to be. And starting tomorrow evening, our late night series, which has had a bit of an alteration this year and is running Thursday, Friday, Saturday, will start at the Cirque, which is a performance house on Yonge Street. And I would encourage you to check that out. That's going to start at 10:30. So after, if you're a person with lots of stamina, come to the theater and then to hear all those wild Newfoundlanders, and then head over and have a great performance evening at the Cirque. And if you don't know all the stuff, you can check the website, which you probably remember. Oh, see, music to my ears. Or grab one of those programs. They're going fast, but we're getting there. So tonight it's my great joy and privilege to introduce to you six different writers. Some of these writers you'll have encountered and some you will not. I think it's fair to say some you will not have, because at least two of these writers, three of these writers, are here with very first books. It's a wonderful lineup and very eclectic, and it's going to give us all a bunch of different kinds of glimpses of what it might mean to be surviving adolescence. Our first writer tonight is no stranger to people who are interested in reading about resilient, courageous, funny, cheeky teens. She stole a lot of hearts with her Alice books, and she has a brand new book of a completely different flavor, I think it's safe to say, called Another Kind of Cowboy. Please welcome Susan Juby.
When I decided I was going to branch out from Alice, Alice is a character I've been writing about for several years, and I thought, well, I could keep writing about Alice until she was 40-ish and getting sort of pathetic living at home with her parents and having the same kinds of difficulties keeping a job and that kind of thing. But so I thought, I'll try and write something else. And I decided I wanted to try and write every kind of book that I love. And one kind of book that I've always really loved is the horse book. And so Another Kind of Cowboy is a story about two young riders. And I'm going to introduce you to the first character. It's told in the voice of Cleo, who is a 16-year-old girl who's moved to Vancouver Island to a private equestrian school from the States. And it's told in third person, the story of Alex Ford, who is a young man growing up in that town, who very much wishes he was going to the girls' private equestrian school. This is an introduction to Alex. In the beginning, there was Del Magnifico Lenoir. If you didn't know better, you might have mistaken him for a dark blue Norco bike. But to 6-year-old Alex Ford, Magnifico was a 3-year-old thoroughbred, reminiscent of the Black Stallion. Like the Black Stallion, Magnifico was given to bursts of thrilling speed, which is why Alex kept a red dog leash tied to his handlebars. Alex rode Magnifico around his rural neighborhood, whispering, whoa, at stop signs, and using an assortment of what he imagined were horsey noises, such as clucks and peculiar trills, to urge the bike through puddles and over small obstacles. Using a Pony Club-approved slip knot, he tied Magnifico outside the school each day, and each night brought the bike into the garage for a brisk rubdown, covered it with an old blanket fastened with a leather-like belt he'd taken from one of his mother's old pantsuits. Alex kept a dog dish filled with water in front of the bike and hung an aluminum fishnet full of dried grass clippings just over his handlebars. Once, when Alex's teenage cousins were visiting, they stole Magnifico and rode him to the store to purchase cheese-flavored snacks. Upon their return, they left the bike on the lawn, and when Alex found Magnifico lying in the rain, his deflated front tire spinning helplessly, his red leash muddy and sodden, Alex burst into tears. This was just like the time the drunken stableman ruined Black Beauty's knees by galloping him with a rock in his shoe. Slowly, Alex pushed Magnifico into the garage where he inflated his tire and then walked him in circles for over an hour. When he was sure Magnifico was going to live, he made him a hot bran mash, wrapped him in extra blankets, and vowed fervently that he'd never let anything like that happen to him again. To their credit, Alex's cousins felt alarmed and guilty at Alex's dramatic reaction. They even brought the bike an apple to make up for what they'd done. Sometimes, Alex felt as though he was set apart from other people. It wasn't just that he was secretly a naturally gifted horseman with a bike called Del Magnifico Lenoir. He suspected he was different in other ways, too, though he couldn't have said how. Thinking about it made him uncomfortable, so he didn't. Instead, he tended to Magnifico and immersed himself in horse novels and reference books. He diligently committed to memory the complete encyclopedia of the horse and Horse Husbandry, a compendium. He took the two giant reference volumes out of the library over and over again until the librarian, who'd apparently noticed Magnifico wasn't actually a horse, told him he had to give them a break because conceivably someone else in the neighborhood might want to know something about looking after their bikes. Alex just blinked owlishly. Fortunately, soon after the librarian cut him off from the reference books, Alex discovered horses on television. He was awed by the dashing horse and rider teams who careened around the courses and flew over looming jumps. In no time, he'd learn the names of all the top show jumpers on ESPN. Alex wasn't simply watching the horses on screen. He was the horses on screen. His head jerked up and down as the horses cleared jumps and obstacles. And when one of them hit a pole or stumbled, he'd develop a sympathy limp that could last as long as an hour. Then one day, Alex found a new horse sport on TV. The announcer called it corsage. Alex was instantly mesmerized by the riders who wore top hat and tails and rode their massive horses in intricate patterns around a low-sided white ring. The horses didn't jump. Instead, they walked, pranced, cantered, forward and sideways, in circles and across the diagonal. At times, they trotted in place. At other times, they flung out their legs so far they seemed almost to fly. All the while, their riders sat perfectly still and elegant. This corsage riding was astonishing to Alex. It was like dancing with your horse. At the first commercial break, Alex nearly levitated off the couch. With his back straight and his hands held elegantly in front of him, he pranced across the room. He cantered a few steps forward, then sideways, Imaginary music swirled in his head. When the commercials ended, he rushed back to the couch to continue watching. He was in love with the horses. He was in love with the riders. But most of all, he was profoundly in love with Corsage. He watched the rest of the competition in a state of barely suppressed exultation. The names of the movements called out by the announcer, Piaf, Passage, Pirouette, were all so French. Even the word Corsage appealed to him. When the program ended, Alex was on his feet again, passaging boldly around the living room. He rolled his shoulders, lifting his knees as high as they'd go, until his father came out to the doorway and broke the spell by calling out, "Jesus, Darlene, how much sugar has he had today?" Alex ignored his father and swept past him to the garage, where he put on Magnifico's best seat cover and rode up and down the driveway as elegantly as he could. Alex knew exactly what he'd do when he finally got his own horse. He was going to wear a top hat and tails and ride in a low-sided white ring, a massive crowd cheering in the stands and beautiful music all around. He was going to become a corsage rider, and he was going to dance with horses. His Aunt Grace happened to be visiting that day, and after she watched him ride Magnifico in a perfectly symmetrical figure eight, she asked him what he was doing. "Corsage," said Alex, stopping Magnifico by pulling on the handlebar leash and putting down his feet. "Corsage? You know, that kind of riding people do in the white rings with the letters?" Grace kept her face very still. "I think you might mean dressage," she said. "Corsage is a kind of flower arrangement." "Oh," said Alex. He stared down at Magnifico for a moment, then looked up at his aunt. "Really?" "Absolutely. But let's see some more dressage. I think you're doing some excellent work out here." "Okay," said Alex, his face lighting up like someone had flipped a switch. Unfortunately, Alex's parents didn't share his aunt's enthusiasm for his new passion. His parents had no sympathy for his horse-riding ambitions. In fact, his mother seemed actively to thwart them. Whenever the subject was raised, she'd wail that a horse would be the end of them, the absolute end. "Dirty, filthy thing," she'd say, her lipstick mouth curling over shiny, bleached teeth. "We have nowhere to keep one. Do I look like a farm wife to you, Brian?" she demanded of her husband. "Well, do I?" Alex's father would shrug his big shoulders and sigh, and send an apologetic glance in his son's direction. Alex wasn't even allowed to go to horse camp. Every summer, the twins, Maggie and May, went to martial arts camp. But instead of horse camp, Alex was sent to a dingy, overgrown Pentecostal Bible camp. The Ford family wasn't religious, but Bible camp was cheap, and it was close. The low cost was achieved by feeding the campers a diet of pure reconstituted starch. Every summer, Alex, a slight boy, nearly doubled in size. He came home looking nearly as pale as the other campers, as well as puffy and convinced he was going to burn in hell. The summer he turned 11, Alex was surprised when his father was the one who came to get him from camp. Mr. Ford was mostly noticeable around the house for his absence and his silence. His wife treated him like an annoying, barely functional household appliance. As a result, Brian Ford spent as much time as possible each day at Turnaround RV, the used RV sales center he owned, and his nights at the Wheatsheaf pub. He left his wife to reign over the house, a task she accomplished through elaborate personal grooming and questionable redecorating schemes. She mostly encouraged her three children to stay out of her way. On the drive home from camp, Alex appreciated his father's attempts to make conversation, but was uncertain how to respond. When his father said, "Hey, bud, how they hanging?" Alex offered him a wary glance and a tortured smile. His father's questions about vehicles Alex had seen around Bible camp fell similarly flat, at least until Alex remembered that Reverend Bill had a new vehicle, purchased, presumably, with money saved on vegetables and fruit. "Reverend Bill's got a new car," he said. "Yeah, what'd he get?" Alex thought for a long moment. "A blue one." "Blue?" Alex nodded, added desperately. "Yeah, I think it might have been one of those V8s. He was under the mistaken impression that V8 was one of the big three automakers. "Well," said Mr. Ford, and he didn't ask another question for the rest of the ride home. By the time the big black truck pulled into the driveway, Mr. Ford had perked up again. "I think you're going to be real glad to be home," he said. Alex agreed. While inadequate in many ways, his home and family were a definite improvement over Bible camp. When they got out of the truck, Alex's father reached into the bed of the pickup for Alex's duffel. "Notice anything new around here, bud?" The house remained box-like and vinyl-sided. The lawn was a chemically induced bright green. There was no garden. No. Alex was beginning to suspect a trick. "Are you sure?" He jerked his head around again. Suddenly, he noticed white tape fence peeking out from behind the house. "You put up a fence," he said. "Why don't you go have a look?" Alex walked along the side of the house to the back. White fencing suspended on thin metal posts now enclosed the entire back of the property. As Alex cleared the edge of the back deck and walked past the trampoline, his heart contracted as though gripped by a giant hand. Standing among the stumps in the clear-cut pasture was a white horse with several large red patches and a long, shaggy mane. Alex stood with his mouth hanging open, his gaze fixed hungrily upon the animal. The horse continued snatching at grass as though it hadn't eaten in a month. "That's right, bud. I got you a horse. Name's Colonel Turnipseed. But that sounds kind of girly, so I think it's best if you just call him Turnip." For a terrible moment, Alex thought he was going to throw up. He had hit excitement, passed through joy, and wound up nauseous. As he struggled to control himself, he gradually became aware that his sisters and mother stood on the deck behind him. Maggie and May wore matching grins. The look on his mother's face was considerably less enthusiastic. "See, Brian, he doesn't even know what to do with the thing. I'm going to end up having to walk it," said Mrs. Ford. "He knows," replied Mr. Ford. "Go ahead, bud. Guy I got him from said he's real quiet." "Dad won him from an old cowboy in a poker tournament," said Maggie. "An alcoholic cowboy," said May. Mrs. Ford rolled her eyes. Alex turned back to the horse, and it lifted its head and looked right at him. Everything else faded away. Finally, Alex found his voice. "Is there any tack?" Mr. Ford looked confused. "A halter, bridle, and things?" "Oh, yeah, the guy put all his stuff in the shed when he dropped him off yesterday. Nobody's touched him since." Alex strode over to the green plastic garden shed, and after rooting around for a moment in a tangle of equipment, extracted a threadbare nylon halter and a frayed rope. He found the opening in the flimsy tape fence and slowly walked to the horse's shoulder. Everyone fell silent. Up close, Alex could see that the horse's belly was round, but his ribs and hips were visible, and his coat was covered in welts and bite marks. "Hey, boy," said Alex. The red and white horse turned its head and then sniffed at the hand Alex held out. And only fumbling a bit, Alex slipped the halter over the horse's head and carefully arranged the rope so it wasn't wrapped around his hand. The horse stood quietly at his side. Finally, Alex looked back toward the house, a huge smile illuminating his normally solemn face. His father and sisters beamed back at him. His mother was nowhere to be seen. So, thanks very much.
That's Susan Juby. Thank you so much, Susan. One of my great pleasures, as I think I've said in this room before, is encountering work that I didn't know existed. And a manuscript came across my desk a few months ago now with a pretty brilliant title, "Exploits of a Reluctant but Extremely Good-Looking Hero." I thought, I want to know about that. As it turns out, it's one of the funniest books of the year, and I'm delighted to say that the writer of this book is from Winnipeg. This is her first book. Please welcome Maureen Fergus.
Thanks very much, Charlene. And Susan, just a great reading. That was really, really great. I can't wait to read the book. Yes, as Charlene said, this is my first book. And the book is about... It's written in diary-style format. It's sort of the musings of a 13-year-old boy who's pretty outrageous, kind of pretty opinionated, and as the book travels through, kind of through to conclusion, he finds himself reluctantly caught in between the local business group that wants to shut down a soup kitchen and the soup kitchen that wants to continue to provide for the community. So the part that I'm reading doesn't really need any setup. It's pretty self-contained. So as I'm reading, I will pause occasionally, and that's just sort of at the end of a diary entry and the beginning of a new one. Okay. "Today in family life class, Mr. Bennett told us that this term we are going to divide into couples and babysit an egg for a whole week in order to learn about the responsibilities of parenthood. I said I hope this wasn't related to the exercise we did in science where we had to package up an egg and drop it from a second-story window without breaking it, because I would never do that to my own child, and plus my egg smashed to smithereens because I didn't bother to package it very well. Mr. Bennett said, don't worry, so then I asked if the exercise was going to include any same-sex couples. when he said, "I'm not sure." I pointed out that there were probably people in this very class who were struggling with the issue of sexual orientation. I asked, "Who are we to send the message that homosexuals shouldn't be allowed to experience the miracle of life?" I think I had him there. Later, Lyle Philbender said that only a real fruitcake would ask Mr. Bennett about same-sex couples. I told him I wasn't even a fruitcake, that I was only being realistic regarding today's definition of the family, and that he was the fruitcake himself. After that, he began chasing me with a large icicle aimed directly at my heart. So I headed for the schoolyard monitor and spent the rest of the lunch hour crowding around her and mouthing to Lyle Philbender that he should bite me. I feel sorry for whoever gets him as a partner. She and the egg will probably end up in a shelter. I've been paired with Lyle Philbender for the egg exercise, and Missy Shoemaker is going to be a single mother. When I told her that this is no surprise because she is far too brash to ever keep a man for long, she said that it was her idea to be artificially inseminated in order to avoid any unpleasant entanglements for the sake of the egg. I laughed lewdly and said, "If you're looking for a sperm donor, I'd be happy to oblige." But she said she'd sooner eat dirt, so I said, "You're on your own then," and walked away. Missy Shoemaker can be terribly inappropriate sometimes. Imagine choosing dirt over my sperms. Of course, Lyle Philbender is in a real state about being my partner. I told him to look on the bright side. At least I'm good-looking. Then I said he's really going to have to work on his temper now, since eggs are fragile and easily crushed if you smash them with your fists in a fit of rage. I also offered to lend him the feminine you to help him grow into his new nurturing role, and pointed out that we're going to have to get better at conflict resolution now that we're about to become parents. He grabbed the front of his pants and grunted, "Resolve this." He better clean up his act. I don't want him behaving that way in front of my egg. Our egg exercise starts Friday, and already Lyle Philbender and I are embroiled in a bitter custody battle because neither of us wants the egg over the weekend. Mr. Bennett asked, "How do you think the egg feels about this rejection by its parents?" I said I didn't see why the egg's feelings should come before mine, and that mine were that I didn't want it to be stuck with it over the weekend. When Lyle Philbender said, "I agree," I told him how pleased I was to see him making an effort in this relationship for a change. In response, he gave me a vicious pinch and asked Mr. Bennett to be reassigned to another relationship, preferably of the heterosexual variety. I felt huffy about this and complained, "My self-esteem is going to take a real beating if my partner keeps treating me this way, you know." I also pointed out that this was no kind of environment for an egg to grow up in, but Mr. Bennett just said, "Work it out, and I hope you're learning something." In the end, I got stuck with the egg for the weekend because Lyle said he'd pound my head against a wall if I didn't take it. Already, I feel resentful towards the egg. Mr. Bennett handed out our eggs today. I've named mine Henry, although Lyle Philbender insists he will call him Butch. I told him this was going to be very confusing for Henry, but he replied that Butch was much smarter than I gave him credit for. "I know exactly how smart Henry is," I said. "My boy is a genius, and I'm going to spend all weekend telling him what a cretin his other father is." Then I left the classroom without allowing Lyle Philbender to say his goodbyes. In retrospect, I probably shouldn't have used Henry as an emotional pawn that way, but Lyle Philbender really bugs me sometimes, and it was the best way I could think of to lash out at him. I got kicked out of the movie theater this afternoon because of Henry, and as a punishment, I'm storing him in my gym shoe for several hours. The whole experience has really turned me off children and eggs. If only my parents had agreed to give up their symphony tickets in order to stay home and babysit Henry. As a result of their selfishness, I had to drag him to the movie theater, where he evidently created an unseemly bulge in my coat pocket, because I was pulled aside and frisked by the ticket taker, who told me no outside food allowed. I tried to explain that it wasn't food, it was my precious son, Henry, but there was obviously no reasoning with the guy. Just as I was walking over to chuck Henry in the garbage can, Miss Thorvaldsen appeared out of nowhere and asked, "Where are you going with that egg?" What could I do? I gave Henry a little kiss to show my deep affection for him, then turned and walked out of the theater. I had to get a new Henry from the refrigerator because my father made the original Henry into an omelet. I'd put him in with the other eggs because I'd heard it was important for adopted children from another culture to learn about their own people. And also because I was sick of him hanging around me every minute. Regardless, you can imagine my shock when I walked into the kitchen to find Henry's lifeless shell sitting on the counter next to the cheddar cheese and green onions. My father was mortified. He said that when he saw Henry sitting in the egg carton, he just assumed that my project was over. He apologized over and over again, but I said, "It's a little late for sorry, isn't it?" and asked him to please scrape the leftover Henry into the garbage when he was done. This afternoon, I handed a new Henry over to Lyle Philbender. Missy Shoemaker spied the exchange and asked, "Didn't your egg used to have blue eyes?" I told her that Henry's eyes had always been orange and suggested that she mind her own business. "No problem," she replied. "Being the single mother of triplets doesn't leave a lot of time to waste on riffraff like you anyway." Triplets? I can't stand Missy Shoemaker. She is such an overachiever. Henry came to school with an eye patch today. I was so upset that I shrieked as loud as I could, and Miss Thorvaldsen made me put my head down on my desk for 10 minutes. Afterwards, at lunch hour, Lyle Philbender said, "Butch told me those long orange eyelashes made him feel like puking, and that our son had asked if something couldn't be done to give him a more masculine look." When I wailed, "But an eye patch," and shook my head in despair, Lyle just said, "You don't get him until Thursday. I can do what I want with him till then." I'm certain Lyle's turning Henry into a thug just to get back at me. There's no telling where this ugliness will end. Henry was mortally wounded at Lyle Philbender's hockey practice last night, and at this moment he is lying in my locker wrapped in several rolls of scotch tape, leaking his innards all over my math textbook. I was grief-stricken at first, but then Lyle and I discussed our options and decided that the best thing to do would be to get another new Henry, so I'm going to dispose of the leaking Henry on the way home from school and fix us up with a fresh one tonight. I even said, "I'm willing to keep the eye patch, Lyle, if you'll allow me to give the new Henry a bow tie." He wasn't too pleased, but he agreed. It's amazing how a sick child can bring two people together. I feel close to Lyle Philbender in a way I never thought possible. I had a session with my fine-looking psychologist, Dr. Anderson. I told her all about my devotion to Henry and asked if she had any children. When she said, "None of your business," I told her not to worry if she was infertile, because parenthood really wasn't all it was cracked up to be, although I admitted it was easy for me to say because I had Henry. In my most compassionate voice, I added, "Perhaps if you work hard at redirecting your maternal energies, your barren womb won't haunt you so much." She gave me a foul look and asked if I ever gave thought to the consequences of my statements before opening my mouth. "Miffed," I muttered. "Nagging me is not what I meant by redirecting your maternal energies." She ended our session early, which was all right with me. She is still fine-looking, but I'm finding her very critical these days. Perhaps our relationship is getting stale. Perhaps I need a new psychologist. Then again, perhaps she just needs to work a little harder at keeping my affections. Perhaps I will suggest this to her at our next session. We handed in our eggs today because the assignment was over. Mr. Bennett asked how we'd enjoyed parenting, and like the old married couple we are, Lyle Philbender and I chorused, "It sucked." The whole class laughed. Mr. Bennett smiled and said that parenthood can actually be a wonderful experience if you have the emotional maturity to deal with it. I shouted, "That'll be the day," and turned to give Lyle a high five, but he didn't high five me back. I was hurt because I thought we'd grown much closer on account of the leaking Henry incident. So I leaned over to whisper that he really knew how to sap the joy out of a person, and he burped in my face. The class went on to discuss how fragile and precious children are, and Mr. Bennett asked if we thought an egg was a good surrogate child. I said not really and pointed out that eggs weren't very precious at all, since you can buy 12 of them for just a few dollars. "I don't think you need to confuse matters by introducing the whole issue of surrogates either," I added. Mr. Bennett thanked me for my input, but said that his main point had been how fragile and vulnerable both eggs and children are. "Without proper care and handling, both eggs and children can be damaged beyond repair," he said. Then he asked if any of us had damaged our eggs during the week-long exercise. There were a lot of guilty faces, if you ask me, but only Missy Shoemaker confessed to cracking one of the triplets when its tiny homemade flannel blanket came untucked and it rolled against the side of the popsicle stick bassinet while she was rocking it to sleep on Tuesday night. She even admitted that it was her fault for forgetting to double-check that the blanket was securely tucked. I showed it. Tell it to the judge. And told Mr. Bennett that I hoped Missy Shoemaker would be reported to the authorities and also fail the assignment. I didn't bother to mention the several replacement Henrys because I didn't want to distract people from the horror of Missy Shoemaker's negligence, and also because I didn't know if people would understand my motivations. It's not that I didn't like the first two Henrys, it's just that they got broken and one of them got eaten, and I didn't want to hand Mr. Bennett back a bag full of damaged goods. Anyway, just look at what people are saying about Missy Shoemaker, and her egg only got slightly fractured. Mine got completely destroyed, twice. Imagine what they would be saying about me. Lyle Philbender and I got an unsatisfactory mark on our egg assignment. Mr. Bennett said the mark was a reflection of the fact that we'd lied to him about not damaging our egg. He said, I want to send a strong message that if you're having problems coping with your child, the answer is not to hide it, but to get help. I told him I had no idea what he was talking about and said that I was a perfectly well-adjusted young parent. In response, he pointed out that the Henry we handed in was hard-boiled and the original Henry was raw. So I flew into a terrible rage and cursed the day that Henry was born. Mr. Bennett said, "This is what I'm talking about," and added that he hoped I'd be paying close attention to the lessons on birth control. I just rolled my eyes at him. He should know by now that I never pay close attention to anything. After class, Lyle Philbender gave me a smack in the head for causing us to get an unsatisfactory mark. I said I would have been better able to cope if he'd been a more supportive partner, but he just kicked my Adidas bag down the hall and stomped off. I can't tell you how glad I am to be out of that relationship.
That's Maureen Fergus. The book is full of laughs, as you can probably tell, and full of pretty interesting insights as well. The third writer that I'd like to introduce you tonight, I had a chance to hear this summer. He was here at the Fringe Festival with his band called The Fugitives. It's a kind of spoken word, folk, bluegrass, something. I'm not sure what you'd describe this band. Very, very lively. And it was a curious connection for me because I had just finished reading his novel, which won the three-day novel contest, and I was still trying to digest the fact that you could actually write a novel in 3 days. Imagine if we all wrote a novel in 3 days. I wanted to see what kind of person could write a novel in 3 days, and then I saw him on stage. And think, oh, okay, yeah, Brendan MacLeod could write a novel in 3 days, and indeed he did, and it's a wickedly good novel called The Convictions of Leonard McKinley. Please welcome Brendan MacLeod.
Hey, how's it going? Good. Okay. Awesome. Yeah, so this is The Convictions of Leonard McKinley, a three-day novel book. So I'm really glad to be doing it on this stage because it's surviving adolescence, and definitely this is a book about surviving adolescence. If there's one thing that it's about, that's exactly what it is. It tracks a guy named Leonard, and there's four parts of the book. He's when he's 6 years old, and then the second part is when he's in junior high, and the third part is when he's in high school, and the fourth part is when he's in university. And he's like a really serious dude who, like, you know, we all have random thoughts, right? So we'll be like getting on the bus or something, and then for some reason we'll just be like, oh, I want to stab that person or something. And okay, well, we don't all think that, but like we could imagine someone who thinks, okay, whatever. So if you have that thought, then usually you're like, well, I don't want to. I just had that thought. But he takes it very seriously, and he's like, why was I thinking about that? Do I want to? Like, what does it mean that I thought that? And so he does this with all of his thoughts, and as he grows older, his thoughts kind of get, you know, they go from one spectrum to another, and they kind of grow up as he grows up. And so this is kind of like his thought process as he grows up. And so I'm just going to read a bit from like those couple, like a couple of different sections from there to kind of give you the scope of what's going on in the book. I can't read the end because it's supposed to be like, ooh, cliffhanger at the end. So. It's good marketing, too, isn't it? It's like, oh, cliffhanger. Okay, so in this passage, Leonard, he's done, like, he's had this thing with, like, he's a religious young man, and he has this thing with God, and, you know, he's promised God that he'll do certain things, and as long as God makes sure that he does really well at the school dance. And, like, as you do, right? And so he did not fulfill his part of the deal. Leonard didn't. And so now he's like really scared about going to the dance. And then this is him and his father, who's a very like exuberant father, and really just like happy about everything in his kid's life. And so this is him and his older brother and his younger brother all discussing like the school dance. Okay? Okay. Leonard must not go to the school dance. He has failed the Lord, and so he will no longer get to dance with Angela Watson, and the best that could happen would be to avoid being annihilated by God's wrath during Stairway to Heaven. The worst that could happen would be to have to slow dance with Janine Winterston or Sarah Davenport while everyone watches and he loses the school's respect and everyone forgets he's the new star of the basketball team. However, his father's excitement is its own beast. "This is going to be the best day of your adolescence," he says, brandishing a $20 bill. "Here, I want you to spend all of it. I know it's not like nowadays you date or anything, but if you want to get a certain special someone, a rose or something, whatever's allowable according to the rules of cool." "But I don't feel good," says Leonard. Leonard's father tells him it's nerves, he should forget about it. He asks Leonard if he wants to get pumped up by listening to him recount the story of how he met their mother. "At the zoo," says Leonard. "And what happened?" "She was there with another man, and you told him the elephants were on the loose, and he ran away." "I love it!" Steve points out that that story, Steve, the older brother, points out that story isn't even true, but their father says he's too young to be such a curmudgeon and shouldn't ruin Leonard's excitement. This is his first dance ever. "Will there be drugs?" asks Nick, the younger brother. Their father looks down. "Who asked that when they're in grade 5? "No, there won't be drugs. They're illegal, and they make you go blind." "Well, coffee's a drug," Steve, the older brother, points out. "Coffee's a legal drug. Well, John Erdos said that a mathematician was a device for turning coffee into theorem. See, there you go. But he took Ritalin every day. Well, he shouldn't have done that. But he proved the prime number theorem, and now he's probably dead. He died when he was 83. Let's talk about something else." "I want to take drugs too," says Nick. "Okay," says their father. "Which drugs would you like to take?" "The ones that make you go real fast so you could win the 100 meters at the Olympics." "Ah," says their father, "but then you would be disqualified for doping." "But you could take amphetamines and come up with mathematical theorems," says Steve, "and you wouldn't be disqualified for anything." "Who cares?" says Nick. "Math sucks." "No," admonishes their father. "Mathematicians who do drugs suck." They set a very bad example for their students. Leonard tells the family of a speech an ex-convict gave to his health class earlier in the year. The man used to go to people's houses and take a crowbar to their kneecaps because he was a debt collector for a bicycle gang. So the motto was, "Don't be a criminal." He said acid was the best drug in the world, says Leonard, "but we shouldn't do it or we'd start seeing groundhogs in our bathtub." "Exactly," says their father. "Now, you need to look good for the dance. Time to give you a shave." "I have no facial hair," Leonard responds. "I see a few whiskers. Let's lather you up." Nick insists that he gets to shave as well, and the three of them go into the bathroom together. Leonard examines the pinch in his father's plump cheeks, the merry bulbous nose protruding from the shaving cream. He realizes that he might have to go to the dance after all, because he has promised the Lord that he will honor his father forever. Nick applies a second coating of cream to his skin and says he's going to keep shaving until the end of the regular season, at which point he'll grow a playoff beard with the rest of the Calgary Flames. "Good idea," says their father. "I'll do that too." "Won't you get fired?" "I guess. But Leonard's going to make the NBA, and I'm going to make the NHL," says Nick. "And Steve is going to invent the next floppy disk," says their father, "so I have nothing to worry about." But as his father drives him to the dance, Leonard thinks that his father has a lot to worry about. God is probably going to have Leonard stabbed at a urinal tonight, which will probably lead to his whole family suffering from depression. Nick and Steve will probably give up on their dreams. Their mother will work even longer hours to avoid the stress. Then his parents will get divorced, and his brothers will become drug addicts. So his father should stop acting so proud of him. On the pretense of buying chewing gum, Leonard asks to be let off at the store nearest his school so that none of the kids get a good look at his father's fat. After Leonard gets out of the car, he looks up at the thin sheet of his father's smile and wonders if he is dishonoring him with his shame, and if so, that he will be one more reason that he will be on the Lord's hit list for tonight. "Knock him dead," his father calls out the window, and Leonard is left alone. So, that's that part. Leonard... Of course, now at the dance, he meets a girl, and he promises God that he won't kiss her or anything like that. And, of course, as you do when you're 13, things go awry. So, and this is where they go awry. Leonard and Megan go to... this is set in 1992, and I'm about to... they go to see a movie called A League of Their Own. And if you were going to go home and watch A League of Their Own tonight, this is a plot spoiler, so... I don't know what you do in Winnipeg, you know, if you're like, "Let's go to the Writers' Fest and watch A League of Their Own afterwards." Okay. Leonard and Megan go to a movie on a Saturday night. They see A League of Their Own starring Tom Hanks and Madonna, about two sisters on a women's baseball team during World War II. At the end of the movie, the sisters are on opposing teams and have a run-in at the plate, and Leonard gets angry because the snotty sister bowls over the good sister so that the wrong team ends up winning. "That's life," shrugs Megan. Leonard thinks that Megan obviously doesn't believe in God, because if she did, she would realize that the Lord would either give the good sister glory by making the snotty sister trip over her own feet in front of the entire stadium, or at worst, have the good sister tortured and executed for Christianity but still go down in history as a saint. But Leonard does not correct Megan in this manner because she has started to hold his hands as they pass through the parking lot towards the LRT station. The odd car rushes past, heading into the city in the quiet night, and the two of them fall into silence, knowing that this is the moment they are to turn to each other. And Leonard knows that it's not okay with God, especially if Megan's not Christian. He knows the Lord doesn't want him making out with anyone, period, especially not with heathens. But now the station is upon them, and there is no reason to keep moving so that they are leaning in, and before the Lord's Prayer is on Leonard's tongue, there is the strong scent of strawberries and kiwi, and everything warm and wet instead. And so as a result of kissing Megan, he goes home and finds out there's something wrong with a family member of his has gotten sick. And so then he has the following thought process after finding out this, because he thinks it's related to what has just happened with the girl. He thinks because he kissed the girl that God has smitten a member of his family. And for a moment, Leonard curses God and thinks he hates him. But then he thinks he was just kidding. He doesn't hate God at all. He loves God. God is the best. God is great. But a thought is there within him again. I love Satan. And Leonard thinks immediately, that's not true. He hates Satan. I love Satan not, he repeats. Adding the qualifier not, but then he thinks, I hate God. And the whole thing repeats once more. I rail against Satan according to all that was within me, Leonard thinks, slamming the door to his room. He thinks that if he were in the desert with the sand swept before him on all sides and he had yet to eat for 40 days and the devil offered him the stone to make bread, he would cast it aside. And if Satan took him to the pinnacle overlooking the roofs of the holy city and told him to jump in expectation that the Lord would break his fall, he would not commit hubris and put his God to the test. And if Satan took him to the mountaintop and offered him all the kingdoms of the world for his adulation, he would order him away, for it is said to worship the Lord your God and serve him only. But Leonard has not served the Lord, and so the angels will not attend to him. He has allowed the blasphemy inside, and so now it is to be wrung out by the Lord as in the exercising of a demon, and it will be long and hard, and his body and mind will fail him as the devil takes him over and acts from within. He rips a poster from his wall, thinking again that he loves Satan, and no, again, that he does not, and wonders if he's just made himself a sinner. He thinks about the people who wrote the Bible. If they wrote that thou shalt not commit adultery, then they must have thought about committing adultery, or at least about someone else committing adultery. But they didn't think, I love adultery, Leonard thinks, but then he worries that he just thought that he loves adultery. Even though he doesn't, if his dad ever had sex with another woman, he would never speak to him again and he'd break his legs. I love adultery not, Leonard thinks. And then back and forth so hard he could crush a coin in his teeth. For the rest of the night, he wonders about his level of damnation, because he knows in Hebrews it says, God judges the thoughts and attitudes of the heart, but it does not specify how long it takes for a thought to get into our heart, or how long a thought takes to become an attitude, or even what the difference between the two is. I love Satan not, he thinks, wondering what that means, if it was possible to love Satan within like even a second, even if he did not. Oh, thank you. Yeah. Cheers for not liking Satan. All right. I think we all can agree on that, can't we? Yeah. So this is the last section I'm going to read from it, and it's so now he's grown up to be in grade 12, and so we see that his thought progression has kind of taken on different forms, and so now he's in grade 12, and he's serving as a camp counselor at a Christian camp near Waskasoo up in Saskatchewan, and Nick is also working with him as a camp counselor, and Nick is now 15, and he's a hockey player now. Okay. And so this is about, and there's also another character in here. His name is Adam Wilson. Adam Wilson is like the good-looking camp counselor that all the girls like, and therefore Leonard and Nick hate as a result because they're jealous. Okay. As you do. At the end of the second week of camp, Nick organizes a fire along the beach and invites everyone except Adam Wilson, who shows up nonetheless, guitar in hand. Undeterred, Nick tells everyone a ghost story about a man who gets trapped alone in the wilds of Antarctica, and because he is a wimp and can't hunt like a real man, he's forced to eat his own flesh. He eats first from his buttocks, but second, because he lacks forethought, each of his own fingers. But then he's stuck with no way to cut off the rest of his flesh, and so, like a dummy, he slowly starves to death in agonizing pain. The campfire reacts with silence. There isn't even a ghost in that story, says Sylvia. So Nick invents a spontaneous ending where the man turns into a phantom, and goes looking for his guitar, but finds it smashed over his own dead corpse. The end, he says, looking at Adam Wilson. But how did his guitar get to Antarctica, Sylvia demands. That's the mystery, says Nick. Sylvia says that is a dumb story, and asks Adam to play something on his guitar instead. Adam plays Round Here by Counting Crows, and at the end of the night, he and Sylvia are the last two by the fire. Nix walks home in the dark with Leonard, complaining that he doesn't understand women. He says Steve is awesome because he's his brother, but he never would have thought him capable of dating someone like his girlfriend, Ileana, who stops all the trucks in Calgary each time she comes home to visit the family with him. And your girlfriend is beautiful too, says Nick with disgust. And all you play is basketball. I'm a goalie in the WHL. This is Canada. I should be like royalty. Melinda Pajak, Leonard's girlfriend, is very beautiful. One counselor told Leonard she was hotter than God. Plus, she's hilarious. She's always telling awesome stories about shooting her dad in the head playing paintball or how her brother sounded like a sheep when he stuck his hand in a socket and got electrocuted. When they first met at the beginning of the summer, Melinda had gone down on Leonard out on the beach among the rocks. Leonard had held tight to their jagged edges and swayed with the waves, finally closing his eyes over the last porch light in bliss. But now he can't even kiss her because he thinks about being gay. Leonard is confused because he doesn't know if he makes out with Melinda and then gets a boner, if that will be due to his being excited by her or his recent homosexual thoughts, and then he won't know whether he is gay or straight. And if he's gay, there's technically nothing wrong with that, but it's still not expedient, making me hard to be accepted by the church, it's awkward on his basketball team, and like his life in general will need a huge overhaul. But if Leonard simply gives up and doesn't touch Melinda, then this will only push him towards being gay, so he knows he must continue to be physical with her, and this is what he somehow plans to accomplish tomorrow after they finish mini-golfing with her family in Waskasoo. Leonard knows it is simply a matter of determination. He has a three-stage plan to kiss Melinda with purity. First, he must focus solely on her and think normal heterosexual thoughts, like how her breasts are amazing. Then he must hold her afterwards and think only of how romantic and natural it is. And third, if gay thoughts come to mind, he must shut his eyes and tap his head twice, remembering that he and Melinda are as one, and she will let him know himself and the world around him once again. Leonard says goodnight to Nick and reunites with his campers, though he cannot join them in slumber because he thinks and he thinks. And he thinks. Thank you guys very much.
That is Brendan McLeod. And I have to say, as you can hear, Brendan is a born performer. And he is actually doing tomorrow night's afterwards show at the Cirque. As more of his spoken word and musician self, but I'm glad you got a chance to get a taste of him as a reader of writing. His other performances have certain similarities and are always very engaging, so you might want to check that out tomorrow night. I'm very happy to have these last three writers here in our midst as well. And I'd like to begin by introducing you to Janice Kulik-Kiefer, who is a writer that I've been reading for a whole number of years, both as a poet and as a fiction writer. And so when I saw that she had a new novel this year, I was very much looking forward to it. And when I saw that it was called The Ladies' Lending Library, that made me even slightly more enticed. Please welcome Janice Kulik-Kiefer.
Very much. It's very difficult to follow those three amazing readings. So we are the sober sides. We are the, yes, to warn you. Okay. I'm going to read a section from this new novel. All I need to tell you, I think, is it's set in 1963 at a community, at a lake. These are cottagers who are Ukrainian in background. And this is a section dealing with the girls who are, four of them are sisters, and they have assorted friends. And 1963 was the year that the film Cleopatra came out, and it was also the year that Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor had their incredibly high-charged epic romance. And, of course, this is the talk of the beachside community. And one of the girls is obsessed with Cleopatra. The girls' talk jumps about like the sand fleas they bury in shallow graves at the edges of their towels. Bonnie, who has just turned 9, is the youngest. Laura, the oldest, and Katya and Tanya have both turned 12 this summer. As for the others, they take up the slack between Laura and Bonnie. There's something insistent, authoritative about this ranking due to birth date, something Laura's grateful for, knowing as she does that otherwise they'd never give her the time of day. Not only Katya, but all the other girls at the beach, except for Bonnie. If Anastasia Shkurka were here, she'd have a natural ally, but Nastya's delicate, prone to sunstroke and heat rash, and her mother keeps her inside in the mornings when the sun is hottest. Somehow the conversation turns to Nastya, to how sickly she is, how pale and nervous. I don't think she's delicate at all, Tanya observes. I think Nastya Shkurka is about as delicate as a rubber tire. She hasn't any guts, that's all. A thrill goes through the group of girls on hearing the word guts. It's a boy's word, and there's something daring just in hearing Tanya speak it. If Nastya woke up one morning with a pimple on her face, she'd get a heart attack, Katya crows. Nasty, Nastya. Shut up, Laura says this out of loyalty, not because it isn't true. If Nastya were to grow a pimple, she probably would walk around with her chin cupped in her hand to hide it. She's always scared to do things her mother wouldn't like, things her mother would never find out about in 100 years, like looking at the book Laura found in her mother's bedside table and brought with her once to the Shkurka's cottage. You shut right up, Laura says, adding a word that's higher up on the forbidden list than guts. Dupo. Smerdjuce dupo. The girls shiver. Everyone knows that there's a war going on between Katya and Laura. Their last fight has acquired mythic status among the girls at Kalina Beach. Everyone's heard how, that one day it rained, that day of being cooped up indoors with already thumbed through books and decks of cards with the queens or aces missing, Katya had started teasing her sister about her weight. Laura had thrown a book at her, a book that had hit not Katya, but the statue their mother had brought up to the cottage and placed on the mantelpiece, a plaster statue in the shape of a boy and girl kissing under an umbrella. The Martin children knew the story of that statue by heart, how it was the first luxury Baba Larissa had ever owned, the first thing she'd ever possessed that couldn't be worn or eaten. Dido had bought it for her just before he died. It was priceless, their mother claimed. Though if it was such a treasure, why was it up at the cottage? And why had the children heard their father refer to it when their mother wasn't around as that monstrosity? The statue had fallen almost noiselessly. Katya had quickly swept up the pieces with dustpan and brush, but Sonia had known at once. She'd marched in from the screen porch directly to the garbage can, slipped the lid open, and with her bare hands pulled out the shards of the statue. And then she'd had high hysterics, as Laura called them. When she'd finally got around to asking which of them was responsible, Katya had yelled, "Laura," and Laura, "Katya." They had both been punished, made to stay indoors the whole of the next clear, sunny day, with Laura forbidden to visit Nastya and Katya to run off to Tanya's. As for the statue, its pieces were put in a cardboard box, labeled in Sonia's uncertain script, "Broken Statue," and placed on the shelf beside the screen door, so that every time they went in or out of the kitchen, the girls would see it and feel appropriately guilty. But they didn't. They were preoccupied with other feelings. It hadn't been the punishment so much as the sense of injustice that had poisoned the aftermath. Each of the sisters convinced that the other was to blame, both unwilling to bury their differences and unite against their mother. There'd been something else as well, something ugly and invisible, like a terrible smell that seeps into a room. For the first time in all the years of their being sisters, Laura and Katya had understood that in spite of what people were always telling them, there was something thicker than blood. There was the possibility of something sharp and hard and persistent, something you couldn't unfeel. Instead of deflecting their shame at having broken their Baba's treasure, instead of whispering to each other, "Stupid old statue," and "Who cares if the monstrosity got broken?" they'd put an icy silence between them, broken only by jabs at each other whenever an audience cropped up. Smerdjuce dupo. Laura's taunt hovers in the air, a party balloon that won't pop. Hearing it in Ukrainian is far more exciting for the girls than if Laura had used the English words. It's as if they've overheard their grandparents swearing. Everyone waits for Katya to hit back, knowing she's taking her time, waiting for effect, preparing an insult far more devastating than "smelly bum." When Bonnie pipes up in her sweet, clear voice, "Tell us a story, Laura," she pleads, picking up a fistful of sand and letting it dribble out her fingers, the white and black grains finer even than salt and pepper pouring from their shakers. "Tell us ball erectory." Tanya sniggers. When Laura pokes her with an elbow, she puts her hand to her lips, as if the snigger were a fly that had flown into her mouth and disappeared. "It's called ball rectory, Bonnie, and I told it yesterday and last night, and I'm sick of it." Laura's been elected storyteller this summer. From the English girls at school, she's picked up dozens of ghost stories that they've learned at summer camp, along with how to make pinecone necklaces and miniature teepees out of birch bark. Ball Rectory is about Albania, whose lover is killed by an evil lord in a duel. She has a child out of wedlock in a convent, and both of them perish of hunger and cold at the hands of the abbess, who is the sister of the evil lord, and who is tortured ever after by the wails of the perished Albania and her newborn child. "I am sick and tired of that story," Laura grumbles. "I'll tell you Cleopatra instead." Bonnie exhales slowly, careful not to let her sisters see her relief, determined to keep the peace for as long and as invisibly as possible. The girls lie spread out on their towels, sometimes spitting a few grains of sand from their mouths or twitching their bodies when the flies crawl up their calves. Laura alone sits cross-legged, reciting from the souvenir booklet. Her voice takes on a deep, reverent tone, ringing out over the blankets and echoing between the dunes. "We, as we read the deeds of the Queen of Egypt, must doff our modern conception of right and wrong. And as we pace the court of the Ptolemies and breathe the atmosphere of the first century before Christ, we must not commit the anachronism of criticizing our surroundings from the standard of 20 centuries after Christ." "Is that English?" Tanya asks. Laura ignores her, but then Katja joins in. "What does anachronism mean?" Katja's only asking because she thinks Laura doesn't know that she can trip her up in front of all the others. "It's a kind of sin," Laura says loftily. They seem to expect something else, and so she blunders on. "It's something you commit, like communism." She's thinking of the photograph that appears in the book above the words she's just recited, words picked out in huge black print. The picture shows a banquet hall with silk-draped walls under green and purple lights that remind her of the peels of cucumbers and eggplants. It's a small picture, but you can still see a man whose skin only goes as far down as his hips and whose legs are covered with fur. Two other men are wearing skorts, like in gym class, and ladies in bikinis perch like budgies on swings, watching as the men in skorts dance between lighted torches. "Beautiful and seductive Cleopatra was, but she was also a hereditary ruler, a woman of rare spirit and courage, cosmopolitan and yet superstitious, ardent and at times lonely, and always proud. Her conversation was known to be scintillating, her mind keen." This is the part Laura likes best, for though she knows she'll never be beautiful, a rare spirit and scintillating mind are things she can train herself to acquire. The way she was able to cure herself of flat arches by picking up marbles and pencils with her toes every night for a year. The word ardent especially enchants her. It makes her think of small golden arrows, thin as fish bones, and with flames instead of feathers at their ends. "Cleopatra's father, Ptolemy XIII, had stated in his will that she was to share the throne of Egypt with her younger brother, Ptolemy XIV. But he plotted against her and threatened to kill her, and she was forced to flee to Syria." "Who's Syria?" Impatient with the interruption, Laura stops quoting from the souvenir booklet. She tells them how Julius Caesar, having defeated his rivals in battle, travels to Alexandria to decide who should inherit the throne of Egypt, and how Cleopatra has herself wrapped up in a carpet and carried to him just like a hot dog in a bun so that her brother won't find out and stab her in the back. Tanya nods, hearing this. Her brother is 9. He would stab her in a minute, she says, if she didn't watch out. Laura ignores her. Cleopatra's faithful retainer, Apollodorus, who is silently and hopelessly in love with the queen, carries her into Caesar's apartment as if he were trying to sell him the rug. Why would Julius Caesar need to buy a rug if he was absolute master of the Roman world? Why wouldn't Apple, whatever his name is, take the rug to Caesar's wife instead? Katja's questions are imperious. "She was in Rome," Laura shoots back. "The wife doesn't matter. Cleopatra does. When she stepped out of the rug, like a showgirl from a cake, he was charmed by her beauty and her cleverness, and he fell in love with her forever after." "But you said he had a wife." "If all you're going to do is make stupid remarks, I won't tell you anything," Laura fumes. at which point Darka returns, dripping water from her brassy hair and clutching a movie magazine with the word Sybil's Anguish screaming from the cover. Darka bends down to wipe Alex's nose. The baby retaliates by grabbing the magazine, tearing off the back page and crumpling it into a ball, which she proceeds to suck on. Darka retrieves the rest of the magazine. Expertly, she spreads out her towel, flopping on her back, pulling her straps down from her shoulders. The girls nudge one another, even Laura's included, at the sight of Darka's big breasts bulging under the top of her two-piece. And then their heads dive down and they pretend to sleep. The noise they hear this time is the mother's flip-flops climbing up the dunes. It's Sonia, all out of breath, her hand like a visor over her dark glasses. All she sees is the baby stuffing paper in its mouth, while Darka soaks up sun like a great soft starfish. "Darka!" she shouts. The edge in her voice makes Laura think of the strip of metal on a pack of wax paper. "I need you up at the cottage. It's time to start lunch. Bring the baby with you." Darka slowly folds her arms and legs together, and her eyes still closed, starts pulling up the straps of her bathing suit. For some reason, this irritates Sonia more than the baby's chewing on the pages from Darka's magazine. "For God's sake, don't take all day, Darka. I'm not paying you to sunbathe." "You're not paying me, period," the girls hear Darka grunt as she stands up and kicks her feet into her flip-flops. The baby bats at her with a plastic shovel as Darka stoops to pick her up. When she reaches the path to the cottage, Sonia turns and calls to her daughters. "Laura, Katya, Bonnie, shake out your towels and come up with us. Right now, do you hear me? No dawdling. Laura?" Laura just sits with her fine hair flapping into her eyes, listening to the howls of baby Alex. She is saying her mother's name over and over to herself, as if calling her Sonia rather than Mama will diminish her power, shrink what Laura calls the world of the mothers, a world apt to swell up over their children and press down on them at the same time, a world of "because I said so and I told you so," of "what is it now and that's just the way it is." It's this last refrain that troubles Laura most, the law verging on commandment that life, everyone's life, is fixed in a pattern rigid as the wool of Baba Motria's kilim, the black rug woven by Baba Motria herself, a treasure, a monstrosity like the statue of the boy and girl beneath the umbrella. Recalling the stiff heaviness of the kilim, Laura thinks of how different men's lives are from women's. In men's lives, there's some give to the weave. There are holes you can slip through and escape from. Whereas women are stitched fast to their lives, stitched and slammed and stuck together like the wool of the kilim, with its clumsy, shrimp-colored roses, its moldy basement smell. Thank you.
That's Janice Kulik-Kiefer, and it's a very extraordinary, tight-knit and rather frightening and very beautiful community that she writes about. Beautiful novel, Janice. My next guest is a writer who's been called the preeminent, chronicler of Chinese-Canadian life. And he's written and published several very, very powerful and beautiful histories of Chinese-Canadian experience, and has established himself also as a writer for children. And last year I came across his collection of writing that features older protagonists, kids in their teens and at the end of their teen years. And many of these stories were so moving that I just had to try one more time to get him to come here to our festival. I'm very pleased that Paul Yee can join us. Please welcome Paul Yee.
Before I start, I have to explain TOEFL. TOEFL stands for Test of English as a Foreign Language. It's a test that a lot of immigrant kids have to take before they can get into college. Okay, the story. "Are you still listening to that Sui Jian?" Shelley walks into the condo and grins. "He's so ancient." Her perfume is heaven, and I pull her close. Her backpack drops to the ground. "Well," I murmur, "at least he still writes his own songs." "You," she whispers urgently, "need to speak more English." I fling my arms out. This famous singer, I shout, is the father of rock music in China. I pretend to be the star MC introducing Sui Jian to millions of screaming fans at the Sky Dome. It's his first international tour. I shout into the microphone. His songs cause government to fear him. Central government ordered TV stations not to broadcast. She covers my mouth with her hand. Her hair glistens with purple and lime green and blue streaks. Ah, a kiss is coming. His songs cause the government to fear him. She's correcting my English. The central government ordered the TV stations not to broadcast his songs. I fall off the stage and break into pieces. I cannot pass the exam, I say. Sure you will, she says. No, I say, I cannot remember so much things. I deliberately use bad English because I want her to correct me and then hug me. It works. So many things, she says. And I whisper, my father went out. We can go lie down. Or, she says, we could study for the TOEFL. In a while, I say, in a while. She wiggles away. I came here to study, she says. Unlike you, I have to pass the exam. Well, I must pass it too, I say. Well, you won't, she says. Not with that attitude. What attitude? Shelley is determined that I succeed. If I pass this exam, she says she will sleep with me. The toughest part of the TOEFL will be the second section, where we have to fill in the blanks with correct grammar. In English, small words are big trouble. It is, do you have a girlfriend? Not, do you have girlfriend? It is, do you have the money? Not, do you have a money? My father pays $500 a month for a tutorial. I go every Saturday morning from 8:30 until noon. The teacher says, all the students will pass, otherwise we get our money back. I don't see how he stays in business. There is so much to memorize that last week I went to Blockbuster to rent another brain. Listen, I am not stupid. Back in Shanghai, the teachers praised me. Song lyrics used to stick to me like wet toilet paper. I knew all of Sui Jian's songs. Going back to that hometown place, find the old road and go for a race. I want to go home. Those songs are my life. Homework has no energy, no melody, no backbeat, and worst of all, no ending. The TOEFL will also test our listening skills. They play a recorded conversation, and we have to pick multiple choice answers. The tutorial teacher lent us a CD. It's my turn to ask Shelley the questions. There's a knock. I go to the door. Darren, how are you? Says my mother with a smile. What is she doing here? Her hair is curled, it's cut short, she wears tiny earrings, and as usual, she looks very stylish. I turn and call out to Shelley. Question 22 is, what does the man mean to say? A, women never tire of shopping. B, this woman is tired. C, shopping with this woman was very tiring. Or D, the man needs to buy a tire for his wife's car. And then I turn to my mother and say, in English, I am studying. My friend comes to help me. We are very busy. And my mother gives me a look that says, what, are you crazy? And she marches into the room and calls out, I'm Darren's mother. And Shelley jumps up and says, Auntie, you're well. We were just studying for the TOEFL. TOEFL? Mother gives me a look. Didn't you already write that? No. And then Shelley, mother says to Shelley, well, don't let my stupid son hold back your progress. And I say to Shelley, question 23 is, what does the son really think? A, he is sad. B, he is disappointed. C, he is angry. And D, he is resentful. I came to take you to lunch, mother says. And she pats Shelley on the shoulder. Oh, you must come too. Shelley is loading up her backpack. Oh, no, 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 she says. I've got to go. Mother lets Shelley run out of the apartment. Thanks, mother. Mother is checking her makeup in the mirror, and she calls out, did I frighten your friend, or are the two of you hiding something? Hurry, hurry, she says. I came to take you to lunch. Aren't you glad to see me? I haven't seen you in almost a year. When I don't answer, she goes to the refrigerator. She peeks in and calls out, there's nothing here. I'll go buy some food and cook you lunch. No, no, anything but her cooking. I grab the phone and call for a cab. On Sundays, the beautiful China restaurant is especially busy. It's good to see a few tables of white Canadians among the sea of Chinese faces. Mother flirts with the host, so we receive seats right away. I look around for friends. I see kids punching computer buttons, leafing through magazines, talking on their cells. Their bodies are all turned away from their families. Unfortunately, mother and I must face one another. I have my own business now, she says brightly. In this conversation, she will have to speak both parts. I came to eat. Mother switches to English. Your father, she asks, does he have girlfriend? I say, ah, girlfriend. And she says, only one? And I say, your sentence was wrong. You should have said, does he have a girlfriend? Mother switches to Chinese. Your grandmother misses you very much, she says. She asked me to bring you these. She hands me a package. It's full of brand new CDs. The latest release is from Dao Lang and the gang. Grandmother brought these? Mother must have. She's afraid I'll refuse them if I think they came from her. Good. She knows how I feel. So I toss her the question I've been waiting to ask. Why didn't you take me with you to China? You knew I hated it here. How would I have taken care of you, she says. I had no job, I had nowhere to stay, and your father wouldn't send me any money. Well, yes, I remember hearing all those arguments. But, she says, if you still want to go, I will arrange it. You can come with me next week. Next week? Really? Really, she says, I can afford it. Well, of course I want to go. I've daydreamt about it so often, it feels like I'm already there. I've spent hours dreaming, walking down Nanjing Road at nights. It's a million times busier than the King Street Mall here. Crowds press in from all directions. The neon lights are a flashing canopy above. Couples walk hand in hand. The security cops are hassling the street vendors. A baritone sings out army songs for pocket change. And the department stores are pumping out high-energy music. I hear Putonghua. I hear Shanghai dialect. For dinner, shall I go to the KFC or shall I go to Gobuli? I am invisible here. Everybody is Chinese, like me. I don't stick out. I'm not trying to balance on some emotional tightrope way up high somewhere, reaching for a balloon that evades my grasp. Mother says, when you come back, you can go to school or do whatever you want. There are private colleges and training schools, or I can set you up in business for yourself. She looks at the food. Is this enough? And I say, oh, it's plenty, plenty for today. I go shopping for gifts to take to China. Back at the condo, Ba is sitting on the sofa. His feet are on the coffee table. My books are still on the dining table. I hope he saw them and was impressed. Well, he says, have you made a decision? He's watching the 70s show. I don't know why he bothers. The jokes are so hard to get. And he says, your mother phoned me today. With me, he speaks only English, trying to help me learn the language faster. And I say, of course I want to go. Then go, he says. You're old enough to think for yourself. I wait. There is more coming. There's always more coming. Doctors like people to listen to them. Back in China, people looked up to my father because he had the power over death and bad breath. My friends thought I was lucky being the son of a doctor, but hey, medicine always tastes bitter. Ba says, if you go back, you go back as failure. Ah, failure, I say. You go back as a failure, Ba says. You like that, huh? Behind your back, your friends will be laughing at you. They will say you could not master the English language. You could not pass the TOEFL, and that is why you go crawling back to China. I explode in Chinese. You don't know a single one of my friends. But that is the truth, Ba says. And I say, lots of people are going back to China. And he said, and lots are staying. Think clearly before you act. The air is clean here. The parks have grass. At Niagara Falls, you can cross into America without any trouble. Soldiers cannot stop you on the street here. If you go back, people will not only say you are stupid, but that you have no long-term vision. You cannot even see that your own children's future will be better here. Back in my room, I turn up the music loud. I can't stand talking to my father. He has no idea what I am thinking. When I talk to him, it is as if I am underwater. He is deaf to everything but his own thoughts. He has no idea how difficult my life is. And he is a failure too, a bigger failure than me. The medical board here would not recertify him as a doctor. He had to retrain as a nurse. When mother and I arrived here 2 years ago, he had four pairs of white Nikes parked by the door. Mother saw them and laughed and said, what are these for? Exercise? And that was the beginning of the end of their marriage. So that's from a story from the collection, What Happened Last Summer. The story goes on to find out more about whether or not Darren goes to China and what happens when Darren tells his beloved Shelley that he's going to go away. Thank you.
Wow. That's Paul Yee, who speaks in many voices. Thank you so much. That was a very gripping delivery. The last reader I'm ready to introduce to you is Alice Kuypers, who has a new book called Life on the Refrigerator Door. She comes to us from Saskatoon, but as you will hear by her voice, she has come to Saskatoon from a farther place. I would like you to welcome Alice Kuypers.
Good evening. Can you hear me at the back? Okay. Okay, I'm glad you shouted that because I can't actually see you at all. This is my first book. It's notes. Every single page is a note either Claire or her mother leave one to the other on their refrigerator door, hence the title, Life on the Refrigerator Door. Hey, Claire Bear. Milk, apples, bananas, avocados, onions, potatoes, tomatoes, mushrooms, carrots, and rabbit food for Peter. Ground beef, bread, juice, you choose. If you can carry any more, get a chicken and two cans of beans. Don't worry if you can't. I can try and pick these up tomorrow. Love, Mum. Money on the counter. Don't forget your key. Mum, I bought everything on the list except the chicken and the beans. It was freezing outside, and carrying the bags back, I thought my fingers were going to fall off. I need new gloves. We should go to the store again this Saturday. You aren't working this weekend, are you? Hope you had a good day. Claire. I made spaghetti bolognese for when you get in. Love, Mum. I'm running out the door. I'm on call this weekend. Sorry. Love, Mum. I'm going to spend the night at Emma's. You seemed a bit tired last night, Mum. I hope you're not working too hard. See you tomorrow. Don't worry, I have my key. If you get time, could you stop and get a chicken? I'll cook a Sunday roast tonight. Love, Mum. After starving to death for ages, I made a chicken thing using a recipe off the internet. I put the leftovers in the fridge. I waited for you, but I figured you weren't ever going to get back, so I just put cling wrap on it. Emma never has to cook for her mum. I'm going to school early tomorrow, so I won't see you. Emma's mum is giving us a ride. She took pity on us with the snow. Then I'm babysitting tomorrow night to make some money so I can buy some of the things I need, like gloves, so my hands don't fall off in the cold. Why don't you get a phone? Then at least I could call you. Claire. Dear Claire Bear, I had a stressful weekend. It would be nice to come home and not be made to feel guilty. I hope school was interesting. There's some of the chicken, which was very good, by the way, left over. See you for breakfast. I want to talk to you about something. Love you, Mum. I left some money for gloves on the counter. Claire Bear, I had to go. One of my patients delivered 2.5 months early. January is a horrible month to have a preemie. When's your presentation? Isn't it coming up soon? Let's do something tonight. I feel like I haven't seen you for days. Love you, Mum. Could you get some more apples? Hi, Mum. I can't do tonight. I have to go to Emma's to study. James is coming too, and we're all working on the presentation for tomorrow. I made some pasta with a cheese sauce, so there's no milk left. I didn't get any apples yet. Hope work was fun. How's last night's baby? Claire. Could you leave me $10, Mum? Hey, Claire Bear, I picked us up some milk and some more bread. There's more fruit and veg too, including apples. Thanks for the macaroni and cheese. Very good. You're a better cook than I am now. I'm booking you for breakfast on Saturday. I have to talk to you. What's the money for? Mum. Hey, Claire Bear, nice to see you last night, if only for a minute. You seemed all grown up when you left. I forget sometimes that you're only 15. I'm sorry. I realized just now that I forgot to ask how your presentation went. I'll be at work late tonight. Dr. Goodman is away and we're all working 3 times as hard, it seems. Is Saturday still good for you? We do need to talk properly. I love you, sweetheart. Claire, Peter's cage needs cleaning. Poor rabbit. Love, Mum. Hi, Mum! I got an A! Well done, darling, that's terrific. Was it an important presentation? Mum, it was really important. If I ever saw you, I'd be able to tell you stuff like that. I can't believe you had to ask. I'm not coming home until late tonight. Emma's parents asked me for dinner. I might stay over if it keeps snowing. I'll call to check with you. Tomorrow night, I'm babysitting again. Well, Claire, now I feel like a terrible mother. Why don't we try and have a regular night where we talk about everything you've been doing at school? We used to do that, remember? See you Saturday. We'll talk properly then. Claire Bear, I can't make breakfast Saturday. Let's try for Sunday night. Could you pick me up some of my moisturizer if you have a minute? I'm all out. Your father phoned last night. He said to call him. Love, Mum. Hi, Mum. I'm studying at Emma's for my test. You forgot my allowance. Again. What did you decide about Sunday night? Love, Mum. Mum, please, please, please put my allowance out. Hi, Mum, who I never see anymore, ever. It's Emma's birthday on Sunday, so I'm going to be at her place. I was going to stay at hers tonight too, but Dad asked me to come over, so I'm staying at his. He sounded down about something. Any ideas? I got you a jar of moisturiser. Hope it's the one you like. I think it is, but the store is full of different ones, and I couldn't remember. I thought yours was in a white jar, but this one has the right name on a yellow jar. Have they changed it? You need to leave me money next time you want something, unless you want to increase my allowance. I hope you're okay. You said you wanted to talk to me. Maybe I'll get back from Emma's in time for dinner on Sunday night. Claire. Hey, Claire Bear. How was the weekend with your father? I hope he was more cheerful in person than on the phone. Maybe work is stressing him out. He used to get stressed out about work a lot, but who am I to know? And how was Emma's birthday? Claire, honey, I've got a doctor's appointment today. I've been trying to tell you. It's really nothing to worry about, but I would feel strange if you didn't know I found a lump on my right breast. I finally booked an appointment. I wanted to tell you before I went to the doctor's, but I suppose we haven't had the chance. I don't think there's anything to worry about, so please don't think this is more than it is. I love you, sweetheart. Mum. Mum, I can't believe you'd leave me a note telling me something like this. How are you feeling? How was the doctor? Should I be worried about you? Is it anything serious? You never go to the doctor's. I have to babysit, but I won't be late. Love and hugs. Claire. Claire, I hope I've made you feel better, darling, and you're not so worried. As I told you, the doctor was very nice. I'm going tomorrow afternoon to have the mammogram, just to check that everything's fine. The chance of the lump being anything serious isn't very high. I suppose being a doctor myself, I forget to take my own health as seriously as I should. Anything. Anyway, everything will be fine, so please stop worrying. There's really nothing to worry about. Love, Mum. Good luck at the doctor's today with your thing. Sorry I can't come with you, Mum. I have another appointment next week, honey. Do you want to come with me? 4:30 p.m. Monday. If you could get home from school by 4, we could go over together. See if you can make it. Love, Mum. Babysitting tonight, Mum. Gotta run. I can't find my key. Will you be home to let me in? Call me and let me know. Are you seeing your father this weekend? Or do you want to do something together? Love, Mum. Hi, Mum. I'll be back later. We could watch a movie. Could you leave me an extra $20 with my allowance, please? I wanted to get those boots, but I haven't got quite enough. I'll cook all next week. I'm sorry, Mum. I thought I could come with you, but I have this thing at school. Good luck with the doctor. Let me know how it goes. Mum, where are you? I waited for ages, and I thought you'd be home. I called the hospital, but they said you hadn't come back to work after your appointment. I even called Dad to see if he knew anything. Not that he ever knows where you are. I'm worried. Should I be? I looked up breast lumps on the internet and realized I wasn't sure what I was looking for, and suddenly thought that maybe I should have been taking all this more seriously. If you were home, I'd probably be less worried. Okay, I'm going crazy just waiting for you here. Dad called. He's taking me for some food. I'll be back soon. I found my key. Thank you.
That's Alice Kuiper's in a very, very gorgeous book. And I suspect that many of you, like me, will be sitting there thinking, oh, I wish blank had been here to hear this reading or that reading. It's been an evening of just such amazing writing and amazing deliveries. And it just made me think that I should remind you that we are recording all of the evening main stages this week, and they'll be on our website as podcasts. And all of you know the website. Right. So check, it'll be a couple of weeks before we can get all the mechanics worked out for that. But you might want to come back to the site and revisit some of these great readings from this evening and other evenings. I would invite you very quickly to a few things that are happening right around the corner. We have the Nooner still happening for Thursday and Friday at the Millennium Library. Tomorrow is Joel Thomas Hines, who's a wonderful Newfoundland writer who's out there somewhere. I saw him earlier. The afternoon book chat tomorrow is Michael and Kathleen Winter, who are also Newfoundlanders. There's a talk at the Millennium Library by William Gibson at 2. And there's an evening of Newfoundland writers tomorrow evening. There's a great conversation with Rakhiri at CCFM tomorrow. And you get to hear Brendan McLeod again tomorrow night afterwards. And the shows go on and on. Thank you so much for coming tonight. Come forward and talk to the writers.